Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. We like to go all over the place in Real College Podcast. From down deep in caves to House on the Rock in Wisconsin, we are everywhere. But this week, we're keeping it closer to home, looking at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. We've got traditions, we got shoveling, we got design, and more here on Real College Podcast. If you've ever wandered around the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, chances are you've seen the shoe tree. Now, if you haven't seen the shoe tree, it is exactly what it sounds like. A tree covered with shoes that have been thrown onto it. And though this tree is something everyone here knows about, no one really knows why there are shoes on it. Well, this week, Casey McCabe asked students around the U why they thought there were shoes on the tree.
All right, so the question of the week is, what do you think the story is behind the shoe tree on West Bank?
I speculate that it was possibly part of some sort of club's tradition, possibly a graduation or some sort of other event. I don't know if this club is still around or still practices this tradition, but I definitely feel like now with all the shoes in the tree, people just do it because they see the shoes there, and it isn't necessarily for anything. It's just sort of like there's shoes there. I want to be a part of that. Looks kind of dope. Let's do it.
I think that throwing your old shoes in the tree symbolizes your journey through college and then moving on to bigger and better things in the real world.
Would you throw your shoes in the tree?
Personally, I would not, because they're slip-ons.
So you gotta think about like the meaning of shoes, right? We wear shoes when we walk like around the streets and things like that. So I think the shoes in this case symbolize the paths and walks of life. And so when you throw your shoes, when you graduate, that's symbolizing your path in college, right? And like, I think that's really symbolic of like all your achievements and the strength and effort you put into it. So yes, I would definitely throw my shoes in the end. Watch me there. 2022, let's go.
Walking is like a big part of your college experience. And so I think that throwing your shoes that have gone through you with the entirety of your college career, throwing them into the tree is like just symbolizing the end of like your college journey.
So the question of the week is, what do you think the meaning is of the tree on West Bank with the shoes in it?
When students graduated, they throw shoes over the trees to celebrate, I guess.
Do you think that you're going to throw your shoes in the tree when you graduate?
Definitely.
Well, I don't really think there is a meaning, but to me it's just really creepy.
Why do you think it's creepy?
Well, when you look at it at night.
I think the significance of the tree has to be like your walk through your college life. And so once you've completed it, when you graduate, chuck those shoes right up in the tree.
Would you put your shoes in the tree?
Absolutely. I was already planning on it.
Reporting for the Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.
No shock here, but life can get rather snowy here at the U of M. But just because it snows a lot doesn't mean the university stops running. So to keep it running, all the roads need to be plowed and the university's many sidewalks, ramps, stairways, and bridges need to get shoveled. And, well, Nathan Fervoy tells us how all that happens.
Got a lot of snow in this plaza, huh?
Yeah, for sure. But how long you been out? It's like, since what time?
We started at 4 a.m. today.
Oh, man. Yeah, how much snow?
I think we probably got maybe 5 inches, five and a half, something like that, maybe six.
Yeah.
Hard to say. It drifts a lot in here because all the snow comes off the roofs.
Right, yeah.
So some places in here are like 2 feet deep. Yeah, this is the biggest snowfall of the year for sure.
Every time a fresh blanket of snow comes down at night over the University of Minnesota campus, the call goes out to Eric Ulrich and a crew of student first responders. Half asleep in their warm beds, the pre-recorded voice on the other end instructs them to get up and over to the campus ASAP. There's work to be done.
On a regular snow call in, if we had like 2 inches of snow, we'd come in at 5 a.m. and get everything open. And then as the day wore on, you know, we'd broom it and get it clear and widen it out. Make sure our curb cuts and stuff for handicapped people are accessible. And that's a big thing about the campus. You know, they have a lot of handicapped people here, blind people, and, you know, we got to make it suitable for anyone who comes here. Mm-hmm. Probably the main importance is, you know, we want to get the snow up and plowed before all the foot traffic comes to campus and packs it down, and then it turns to ice.
The work is cold and hard. It's essentially being paid to do the one thing no one wants to do in Minnesota in the winter, go outside. But somebody has to put in the time or the campus would grind to a total halt.
Exactly. Yeah, it's got to be done. I mean, it's a busy place and it has to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. My name's Aaron.
And yours too?
My name's Alex. It's kind of difficult sometimes, you know, you're trying to go to bed and then you get a phone call saying you have to come in and shovel snow at 5 a.m.
A year ago, before working for this podcast, I worked shoveling snow for Landcare and got some firsthand experience explaining the job to others. Although from a short description the job sounds pretty grueling and maybe not your ideal student job, I remember it not being all that bad, being outside in the morning light. And the student workers have few complaints.
But yeah, it's actually kind of nice, too. It's good exercise. It's just really cool seeing the snow undisturbed, you know, because we're the ones that shoveling it, so before we get there, the snow is all, you know, freshly laying on the ground, and it's just very natural and kind of beautiful looking.
You go into kind of like a trance-like state at all when you're out here?
Yeah, that's a generous way of putting it, yeah. The sound of shovel on sidewalk is very rhythmic.
Yeah. Yeah, I might have to get some of that sound.
I actually really relate to that, yeah. That trance feeling. Like, it's just so peaceful out there and everything looks so pretty and, you know, you're in the city, but there's no one around and it's just, like, tranquil. And the job, like, sounds like it sucks because, you know, you have to wake up at, you know, really early in the morning and go out in the cold and do all this hard work, but this, like, feeling you get, it almost makes it worth it. Like, it just feels, you know, nice, almost.
Yeah, I totally agree. Especially if you are outside all day and you can see, like, the day change, right? You are immersed in that, and so then moving back into a space where you're not tapped into that natural trance-like rhythm can be kind of jarring.
Yeah.
By working the job that no one else wants to do, us student land care workers began to commune with the land and nature alone on untouched mornings. We look where others don't and give time to the corners and surfaces that otherwise would be overlooked.
You're kind of, you know, sitting there and you're like, man, I did all this work, and it really didn't seem like much because you probably just took care of one stair, like you said, for a whole hour, and and you're just worn out. I've done it so many times that like I could tell you each individual like divot in the pavement in that one area, maybe on this sidewalk or on this staircase. Mm-hmm. Oh, watch out right there. You might, you know, one level is lower than the other or something.
Yeah. Out of 10, like what's the difficulty of today? How bad is it?
I'd say today's about a 6. Mm-hmm. It's cold out.
After years spent working as land care, a special instinct and relationship formed to the outside world.
So, in my 20 years, I think the university is only closed once, maybe twice. And sometimes we're out there in blizzard conditions. There was one time when I was working in St. Paul that I called in, told my supervisor, I was like, it's white out, you can't even see the sidewalks. The contractors weren't in to do some of the parking ramps and stuff like that. And sometimes you just gotta pull off for safety reasons. You know, if you're in a big street truck and you're driving, you can't see the parked cars, or you're driving down the sidewalk, somebody could be walking there or something. You know, you gotta use common sense. I mean, working outside, you get appreciation for being outside. So all those things for me is like important. And, you know, just that, you know, working at the university, there's so much trash that just gets thrown on the ground or, you know, mishandled or blows away. You know, I'm a steward of the landscape, so, you know, I try to make it nice and clean it up and keep it nice for everybody else that comes here. You know, that's our goal, is to make it welcoming, safe, friendly environment to come and go to school at. And I believe in that theory or mission statement.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Nathan Fervoy.
And we're always looking for people to come and work at Landcare, so if anybody reads this and looking for a job, just call the Landcare office and they can set you up. You can work anywhere on campus. You can work West Bank, East Bank, St. Paul. You only have to put in 12 hours a week.
Finally, every now and then, we like to spotlight some research or goings-on here at the University of Minnesota. So, for this final piece, this week, reporter Rose O'Neill talked to one of her professors from last semester about her work on rural design and infrastructure. Here's Rose with more.
My first semester of college consisted of business classes, a math course, and even half a semester learning the ins and outs of Excel. But as it is my first year at the U, I was able to take a freshman seminar. The seminar I chose was Beyond the Suburbs, Living and Working in Rural America. We were the last section of the course to be taught by Professor Ann Zebarth. And at the end of the course, myself and fellow peers were able to reflect with Ann on the class and her career.
Hello, I'm Ann Zebarth. I'm a professor in housing studies at the University of Minnesota, in the Department of Design, Housing, and Apparel, which happens to be in the College of Design. How did I start studying rural areas? Well, I grew up in a small town, Mapleton, Minnesota. It's down near Mankato in the southern part of the state. The town had about 900 people when I lived there. And so I was always interested in rural communities and rural people and what happens to them. When I came to the University of Minnesota as an undergraduate, I was studying and I was taking courses, and I kept thinking about, well, you know, they keep talking about urban places and cities, and I would, in my head, I would sort of convert it to, does this make sense for rural places? Is it the same or is it different? And so that's really how I got started. I was always interested in rural people and small towns and rural places. I ended up becoming a sociologist, and I started studying rural communities, and I looked particularly at housing as an indicator of how rural places change, both sociologically, demographically, for example, economically, and how the political decisions that we make collectively impact rural places and rural people. So that got me started, and I kept being interested in it throughout my whole career. And the more you delve into something, the more it sticks with you. On one hand, it sounds like I only did one thing, but really I'm pretty curious about lots of things. And I just used housing in rural places as kind of a touchstone to look at lots of different issues that happen in those places. I've done all kinds of fun research, but I think one of the most interesting ones was when I worked with a group of migrant farm workers and their allies to look at housing needs for seasonal workers here in Minnesota. And we put together a survey, and they conducted it, and I help them analyze the results and put together a proposal to build some housing here in southern Minnesota to meet the needs of about 30,000 people who show up in the summer to work in the fields. That number's dropped, partly because of technology. We now have Roundup Ready sugar beets, which means that you don't need to hand hoe them anymore to get the weeds out. You can spray with chemicals, and they do. So fewer people need to work there. But still, we have workers who come seasonally to do jobs here in Minnesota, in tourism as well as farm-related, ag-related jobs. And they need housing. And so we worked on that issue. Unfortunately, the housing didn't get built. But it's a problem that goes on, right? And so that's one thing about working in housing and working in rural communities. You solve one problem and another one pops up. You never really finish the problem. So there's always work to do. You guys, you always have jobs. There's jobs out there. It may not feel like it, but they are. So go for it.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Okay.
Tell us who you are.
My name is Mott Stale. I'm currently a freshman here majoring in civil engineering. And my question would just be, what do you see as kind of the future of rural in America? Do you have any like predictions going forward that are kind of seen in trends today or things that you want to see or think that might happen?
I think rural will always be important. There are lots of things that happen in rural America that simply cannot happen in urban America. If you eat, then rural is important to you, right? Because yes, we have some urban farming, but it's not going to be enough to feed the world. And so agriculture is going to remain an important component of the rural economy, along with mining, forestry, fishing, other kinds of natural resource extraction or production. I think that's going to continue. I think whether or not there'll be a rural rebound in terms of population is still kind of unknown. I think fewer and fewer people have experienced rural because we have become more and more urbanized. And so those who adventure out to live in small towns or rural places are going to be are going to be part of that rebound. And many of them are entrepreneurs who can work remotely. So technology offers the opportunity to live and work in rural places. That's a new economy. One other thing, as a civil engineer, I think one of the other challenges is how do we keep our civil infrastructure, solid and functioning around the whole nation, but particularly in rural places. So an awful lot of small bridges and, railroad crossings and other things that need a lot of attention. So as a civil engineer, it would be a niche. Right? Anybody else?
Okay. Question? Hi, I'm Drew Kroll. I'm currently a freshman majoring in architecture. And my question for you is, what's one thing you've learned about rural America that you wish more people would know about?
That rural America is a beautiful, fun, interesting place, I guess. In terms of architecture, one of the things I wish people knew more about was the sort of architecture that's exclusively rural. And I think about those buildings that support rural industry, like barns, and how they've changed, and why we might want to have some historic preservation around rural buildings and rural places. The buildings themselves reflect what's been happening in rural America, and I think that's something that we're losing. We're losing those gamble roof red barns that we think of as the play school barn, right? Now we have CAFOs, confinement, ag, feeding operations. And so they're big, flat, low buildings, very different than other things. What about silos, right? Silos were sort of elevators, were the big sort of vertical building in rural America. And you could see where the town was in the Midwest prairie because the elevator would stick up. And remember, one thing I think is important is that We have a lot of preconceived ideas about rural, myths, if you will, and they aren't always true. You know, rural isn't completely a backwater, negative, horrible place to live on one hand, and on the other hand, it isn't necessarily the best place or the only place to grow up and grow old in a caring community. So I think I wish people would get out of the city and experience rural America and find out for themselves what's important about it. Does that help, yeah. Drew? Yeah? You got something?
Hi, I'm Emma, and I'm a psychology student at the U of M. So I'm from a small town, Fergus Falls, and currently there's a lot of businesses that are having to be shut down or leave. Like Target, for example, left us recently. So would you have any advice for a small town like that who's looking to improve business?
That's a hard one. It's one of the challenges with big box businesses. We were talking about that earlier. But partly because they're vulnerable in the big scheme of things, right? So Target is a big global company. And they can, if they need to consolidate their business from a corporate point of view, then the least profitable or the smallest units or stores are going to be the ones that close first. And so therefore, these rural communities are going to lose that big box resource. Then they're stuck with a large empty building. Right? What are you going to do with that? And they really need to be very creative about how to use that space, that physical resource of a building in their community, and also to think about how to regenerate economic development. Many of them have started business incubators, which encourage young entrepreneurs to start new businesses in rural places and creatively think about how to re-envision their community in that way. Here at the university, we have an extension service which works with small towns and rural places, and there's a community vitality unit, and they're a great resource for communities that are trying to re-envision and restart their economic development. And so I would highly suggest that they contact their local extension service and ask about the community vitality resources there. That's where I'd start. It's a long process, and it should be a whole community process. I firmly believe in engagement, in community engagement, and in encouraging those that don't usually get to make those decisions to offer their opinions and input into the local community problem-solving process. Young people, elementary school students, the elders in your community who are retired and maybe sort of isolated, even in small towns, that can happen, as well as the usual movers and shakers, you know, your mayor and your city council. So the more you get input from the more different people and different perspectives, the more likely those community problem-solving things will actually be successful. Does that help? Yeah. You got a question? Sure.
I'm Thomas. I'm a sports broadcasting student here at the U. Many times throughout the semester, you said that once you've been to one rural place, you've been to one rural place. So can you tell us about a unique rural place that you've been to that kind of stuck out to you, or just a place that you recommend other people to go to that you think is just like really cool?
I think all rural places are really cool, so that's not very helpful. So I guess what's a unique rural place? They're all unique, right? And it seems to me, I've traveled around the world, and it seems to me when you go to a city, it's a city, right? There are some unique things about every city, but there's also a lot of uniform things about cities. Rural places are much more diverse, and rural solutions to rural problems are much more diverse. In cities, you have set sort of institutions that you can expect to find there. In rural places, they may or may not be there. So that's interesting. I think one of the things I would suggest is to go to different kinds of rural places, different parts of the region. So if you go to Gallup, New Mexico, it's going to be very different than if you go to Aiken, Minnesota, right? It's a really hard question. I grew up in Mapleton, and it's kind of a unique place. It's changed from the small town with the bakery, the two grocery stores, the hardware store, the variety store, the clothing store, to pretty much a bedroom community. And so that's a big change for a small town. And you can find out a lot about it. I like to go to cemeteries because they tell me a lot about a town and its history. Just open your eyes, learn to look. Learn to look. If you're in an urban place or a rural place, open your eyes, pay attention, and ask questions. Be curious. It's a great world.
Thank you to my fellow classmates for helping me with the interview, and thank you, Anne Zebarth, for your work at the U and the Beyond the Suburbs course. With RCP Real College Podcast, this is Rose O'Neill.
Well, that's all from Real College Podcast. Thanks to everyone who helped out this episode, Casey McCabe, Nathan Furboy, Rose O'Neill. Real College Podcast is produced by Lizzie Ritchie, Ben Hallam, Liv Riggins, and Nathan Furboy. Alex Schumacher is the host and managing editor. All episodes can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.